Hey guys, you might have heard of Reid Hoffman. He's a legendary Silicon Valley investor who co-founded LinkedIn, and he has a new podcast called Masters of Scale. His guests include Brian Chesky of Airbnb, Reed Hastings of Netflix. Subscribe to Masters of Scale on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked. And this week, we're talking about millennials. What's their deal? Next thing you know, they'll be protesting for the right to marry their phone. Am I right? Phyllis? That's a name that wouldn't understand millennials, right? But before I tell you what we're going to be saying about millennials, the next live show is coming up this Saturday, May 13th at 7 p.m. at the UCB Sunset Theater in sunny Los Angeles. We're combining our favorite two things in this episode, great moments from history and binge drinking. Michael Swaim, Carmen Angelica, Schmitty the Clam, and comedian Blake Wexler are all going to be joining me to talk about great moments in history where everyone was probably shit-faced, including the drafting of the U.S. Constitution, which was just one big frat party. It's going to be a fun one, and who knows, maybe this podcast will be a great moment in history where everyone was drunk. Tickets are only $7, and you can find a link to buy them in the description of this episode or at sunset.ucbtheater.com. All right, millennials. Like most up and coming generations in the process of inheriting the earth, millennials are pretty badly misunderstood. Although it's getting pretty late in the game for us to still have no clue about them. They now make up the biggest portion of voting age Americans. During Trump versus Clinton, they were apparently exactly tied with baby boomers, which are people born between 1946 and 1964, who came up in the 60s and 70s. And the millennials are generally defined as people born between 1982 and 2004, who generally came of age in a post 9/11 world. That's why we call them millennials. It's a futuristic sounding word that in Latin means post 9/11. But those two groups, baby boomers and millennials, were neck and neck in November of 2016. One of them is dying way faster than the other. And it's not millennials, though you might expect it to be with all their mollywater and texting while driving and large brimmed hats. Those have to dangerously limit their peripheral awareness during knife fights. But no, millennials are actually far less alcoholic and prone to illegal drug use than baby boomers were at their age, and might be the least high generation of the last 50 years, depending on where you look for your comparisons with my generation. Those are illegal drugs, by the way. They are dying of opioid overdoses at just a staggering rate, unfortunately. The rest of the country is also dying of opioid overdoses at a startling rate. I think we did a single episode on millennials back when we first started this podcast. I think it was Jason and I, and we talked about the fact that we had just realized they don't give a shit about privacy just as a generation. Also, robots, you cannot scare a millennial with a robot uprising. So stop trying, Terminator franchise. But overall, from where I'm sitting, the complaints that you tend to hear about millennials tend to be a lot dumber and more self-serving than millennials tend to be themselves. I just spent 11 years building a business out of a bunch of mostly millennials, and I can tell you that usually my biggest problem with them is that they will work themselves sick if you don't force them to take breaks and take vacations. I've talked before on this podcast about Robert Evans's trip trip to Iraq as if we sent him there. He just went there and then asked us to reimburse him when he came home with a bunch of great documentary footage and five great articles worth of notes. He's a millennial. Daniel O'Brien once almost worked himself blind. We're going to talk about one specific complainer, leadership consultant named Simon Sinek, who went viral a couple months ago explaining why millennials are a problem in the workplace. And his complaints are just garbage. He blames participation trophies and parents complaining when their kids didn't get good grades and just a bunch of other email forward fodder. One of his complaints about millennials that makes them so hard to work with is that they keep asking for purpose. They want to be inspired. And he seems to be like completely flummoxed. One of our many extremely talented millennial writers, Mark Hill, tore every detail of his argument apart when that video came out. But I think he skipped one kind of palpable subtext of the video because he was too modest to call it out. Mark is Canadian. I think Simon might be so angry because these millennials are too smart to fall for his bullshit leadership techniques. I think that after he spends a weekend with RJ Reynolds executives in the woods giving leadership seminars and doing trust falls, those tobacco executives go back and find that, you know, Simon's artificial leadership hacks aren't working on the millennials. They're asking to be treated like humans, and they dislike working for soulless corporations that kill people. And they're just all around harder to motivate than past generations. Another reason that might be is because they're smarter than past generations. So they're smarter than the people trying to motivate them. Your Simons of the world. But yeah, just in general, that's true of all younger generations. I was born 2 years before the millennial generation started. The exact equivalent version of me who is graduating from my high school this year with the same grade, same extracurriculars. I don't know if there is a clone version of me, but if there were, he would actually be 4 to 5 IQ points smarter than me because of something called the Flynn effect that we have explored and explained relentlessly on this show. But just know that it's a real statistical phenomenon. People everywhere get smarter by about 3 IQ points every decade. And also just know it probably has more to do with all the millennial hate than anything the millennials are doing themselves. We're not going to claim that millennials are just like every other generation. I think they're kind of a uniquely weird generation. They were still forming their brains when 9/11 happened. They're the first generation that's never known a world where the internet isn't a thing and good video games aren't a thing. Those things have baked some weird shit into them. It just hasn't made them remarkable for literally any of the reasons you hear journalists and leadership experts complain about. So we're going to talk about why that is with some real live specimens themselves, some of those talented millennials I was referring to earlier, as well as Brett. I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. I'm joined in studio by Katie. Hey, Katie.
Howdy.
I forgot your last name for a second there.
Oh.
Katie Golden. And Brent, I want to call him.
Brad.
Brad Radar.
Yep.
What's
How's
up?
How's it going?
How's it going, Brad?
His name's Brett, everybody.
Shit.
They're doing a bit.
Yeah. It's Brett Radar.
Everyone knows me from sitting silently in the back of all of these podcasts.
Of course they know him. And it's appropriate that we have these two guests. I think you're a millennial, aren't you?
I guess so.
Yeah. Talk millennials, you guys. We've done one podcast on the subject many years ago in which Jason Pargin and I sat around and wondered about why millennials weren't more concerned about their personal security or
privacy. Yeah.
Privacy is the word that I was looking for. We've covered it from the standpoint of, man, these millennials sure are weird. But we wanted to take a step back because since that time, there's been a number of articles and rants that have gone viral about why millennials are just the worst. I personally have found that not to be the case. I've found that millennials are some of the hardest working, smartest people I've ever hired. There's this rant that we might as well start out with by this guy, Simon Sinek.
That's right.
I can't believe his name is Sinek.
I know.
It's like, so
maybe it's Sinek.
Sinek.
I don't
whatever.
Know.
He has like stupid clear glasses and
yeah.
Looks like a Bond villain if Bond villains didn't have to be intimidating. He sits there and speaks with authority about why millennials are the worst, why millennials can't function in a workplace, essentially.
And Simon Sinek, a little background on him, he's a leadership consultant. He sells books on how to make people work better. He's making a lot of money on just saying that millennials are garbage, that they're terrible workers. There's this ultimate irony that he's making so much money from bad-mouthing people and then like saying, all good things come with patience and hard work, and why don't they understand this? They think everything comes easy, where he's getting all this easy money from just
going around and repeating the same
Yeah.
10-minute speech to people who are like, oh, yes, I agree.
It's like that guy who does the 10-hour work week, and it's like, well, the reason that I'm able to do the 10-hour work week is because I wrote this book called The 10-Hour Work Week that has made me a millionaire. And so, like, he also, like, made money by selling some shitty pyramid scheme type thing. You have to look at how the people are making money who are teaching you how to make money, I think, is a good general practice. He actually has a few books. He has this other thing called The Golden Circle of the Human Brain that is this thing that neuroscientists are like, that's not how the brain works at all. He's full of unscientific evaluations of how the world works, but that he will just liberally and very confidently drop the phrase, the science has shown, repeatedly.
Every single time he says the science has shown, it takes 3 minutes of Googling to see that the science has not shown that.
Yeah, the science has shown the direct opposite of that. It comes down to four things. He says the reason millennials suck are that their parents told them they were special from a very young age and gave them trophies for coming in last. Their parents complained when they got bad grades, and so they never learned how school worked or something. What was his?
Yeah, he was saying that millennials only got into honors classes and top grades because their parents went to teachers and complained.
Yeah.
Which, anecdotally, I've never seen that in action. And legally, that's illegal.
Right.
Here in California, there's an education code that states the determination of the pupil's grade by the teacher in the absence of clerical or mechanical mistake, fraud, bad faith, or incompetency shall be final. So there's no clauses. If the parents are super pissed off, change it, you know, because their kids are little shits or something. I don't know. And then with the participation medals, there's no data that shows that causes people to misunderstand the world as just they're constant winners no matter what. Certainly when I was a kid, I got plenty of participation ribbons. I was not the most.
Yeah, I was always the kid on the soccer team who got the award at the end of the year that was like, best smile.
Yeah.
Best attitude.
It's like
what
school
an attitude
spirit.
On that kid.
Yeah, he's really not playing well and he's not crying, which is good. Give him a reward.
Yeah.
I was best crier. I really cried the
fuck out
of
that. I know it's not an easy solution, and there's reason to push back against blaming the baby boomer generation or the generation slightly younger than them for giving out the awards. It's not like there were 4-year-olds who were like, I want an award. I played soccer
here.
Well,
Simon Sinek keeps being like, through no fault of your own, through no fault of your own. It's all your parents' fault, which is also a very attractive part of his message is that he's saying, look, you guys, it's not your fault. You just got screwed by shitty parents.
He's very conveniently 38, so he clearly doesn't really have kids or maybe has a very young child. He's just very conveniently not the parent of the millennial generation.
Right.
And not raised by the parents who he's blaming. It's just really convenient sort of age to be.
He uses super weaselly wording. He's like, you know, this is probably caused by bad parenting strategies. And then he says, Those aren't my words.
Not my words. Not my words.
Except he just said them.
You just said them.
You're
and
saying them for $15,000.
Yeah. Whose words are they?
He's like, I mean, I didn't invent these words, or I'm not the first to put them together, so right. I'm not responsible for them.
Mark Hill wrote a really great response to this guy's rant, by the way. And we should probably have segments from this rant, because in our retelling of his rant, people are going to be like, this sounds like complete garbage. Why would anybody fall for this? But this was a video that was shared 4 million times and or viewed 4 million times on Facebook. It really did sweep through everybody's inbox the way that that Jimmy Kimmel video yesterday or 2 days ago did.
It's something that is going to be a theme in this episode, is that this argument that the kids are lazy is not something that was invented 5 years ago.
No.
Ever since there have been kids and people older than the kids, there have been people complaining about this stuff. And it's been a message that throughout all of history, and many of the articles that we are going to source from our own site, we're going to link to in the footnotes, there are going to be examples from 5 BC of someone being like,
yeah,
Thelonious is he's playing in the streets with his friend and he's staring at his stone tablets all day.
Right. Yeah, not having enough eye contact.
I think there's like a general psychological phenomenon where you will judge others, especially if they're in an out-group, more for their failings. Say, you're responsible for these, you're at fault for these. Judge yourself less for those, saying, well, there were circumstances. You'll give yourself more credit for the good things you do, like, well, I worked hard and I got this with no help. And when other people succeed, you're like, well, they got lucky. I mean, not everyone is a raging asshole like that, but those are kind of general.
No, that's just
attitudes.
How the human mind works.
Yeah, it's like, not.
Well, that person had good luck. They had good fortune. Or sometimes we'll give them the benefit of skill, but we will never give ourselves the credit for doing something bad, like purposefully or through fault of our own. It tends to be somebody else's fault. What are the other reasons he has for why millennials suck?
Well, he says that millennials confound business leaders because they're unhappy in the workplace despite being given a purpose and lots of free food. He many times refers to, like, they get their free food and their bean bags, but they're still not happy.
Katie's very happy with her bean bag, by
I
the way.
I love my bean bag chair. It's fantastic.
And her carrot sticks.
I sink in
her
there chewing on carrot sticks and won't be seen for a week.
Makes a little
like rabbit munching noises from the depths of the beanbag chair. It is offensive on many levels to think that the reason that millennials only want free food and beanbag chairs and are too stupid to not understand why they have this undefined yearning for something more. Millennials are people. We like having fulfillment in multiple areas in our life. He talks about, like, oh, they want a purpose, as if this is some stupid thing. Like, no, everybody wants that. Once you've fulfilled your carrot sticks and your beanbag, then you go up the Maslow's hierarchy of needs and you want to do something that matters. That's not something to ridicule. That's something real. In all kind of professions, if you build furniture, there's satisfaction in making something that is sturdy and beautiful. If you work at a comedy site, you try to make people laugh. I think there's something really cynical.
Oh,
get it?
Take that, Simon.
Cynical about mocking the idea that millennials want a purpose.
Well, there was an interesting thing in one of the New Yorker articles you sent where they talk about the French Revolution and how in the decades leading up to the French Revolution, people were actually happier than they were in the time maybe 50 years before it. And that there was this sense in the maybe 10 or 15 years or so before the revolution that things were going to be okay and people had good jobs and the economy was doing well in France at that time. Researchers think, and they kind of tie it to a phenomenon that's happening now, which is because people got that sort of glimpse of, hey, this is how life's supposed to be, that they become more dissatisfied with life rather than if they were born into the pit from The Dark Knight Rises and they've only lived in the pit, they wouldn't feel the need for revolution as much. And something about having that glimpse of a life you'd like to live, in our case, having the beanbag chairs and the carrots.
Yeah, I mean, I think that article specifically mentions the idea of racism being over.
Exactly.
We were sold the bill of goods that, well, Obama has been elected, racism is over, and this is a generation that was brought up in the midst of that promise. And then when they get to adulthood and they see all these incredibly racist things all around them, they're going to be hypersensitive to that. They're going to not stand for that. I had somebody ask me recently, they were like, I don't understand the Georgetown controversy over the slavery thing. And I was like, oh, well, it's because a bunch of the school buildings that I studied in when I went to Georgetown and that people for centuries had studied in were named after slave owners. And they were like, but why was it a problem all of a sudden? I was like, because the kids made it a problem, because they like pointed it out. And they were like, why do you think it was? And I think it's this exact thing. It's just that this generation is more sensitive to those things because they were told that's how the world could be.
Yeah, a lot of these people were maybe in high school or middle school when Obama was elected president, and they have maybe some very early memories of the W era, but they turned 10 and Obama became president and they're like, oh, wow, racism's over. This is great. We're in a post-racial America. Or that's what the narrative was in 2008, 2009. Are we living in a post-racial America? And it's very clear that we're not in 2016. And a guy screaming about Mexicans and Muslims becomes president. The millennial generation's like, what? I thought we had this promise. Then maybe the people who were born in the 60s and 70s were like, no, we've been through some shit. It's not fixed. We knew it was never going to get fixed.
I can see how that would seem like a shifting goalpost. People get more and more used to higher standards of living. And that might seem unfair to previous generations where it's like, well, we survived with sticks in our eyes and our shoes were rocks.
That's how Brett and I grew up. That is correct. Sticks in our eyes. It helped us see.
We liked it.
That's the way we liked it, yeah. That's the only way the world can change for the better is if people get used to better life. If everyone's just, oh, well, I guess that shoes are that are made out of
rock shoes.
Rock shoes are fine, them. Yeah. Then, like, we would never change that.
Yeah, I think, like, part of it is natural, and it's just how generations interact with one another. I do think millennials are uniquely purpose-driven. They're uniquely connected to a higher purpose and want to be connected to an overall meaningful purpose. I think they're more politically driven, and I just think they're generally a better generation. I think basically they're the greatest generation of this century. I'll talk a little bit later about this guy. Morley is his last name, and I don't know his first name because I am a journalist. Actually, Joshua Sargent, another millennial, just joined the fray.
Hi, sorry I showed up late. I was playing on my phone and walking in traffic and just not buying diamonds for the past.
Were you not caring about your cushy beanbag
job? I was just in general not appreciating everything that I've been given.
Typical.
I, for one, appreciate my beanbag.
Yeah, you just felt entitled to everything that
I feel entitled to show to up half hour late to stuff.
Yeah. That's not true. We knew he was going to be late. He messaged that well in advance. But anyways, I was talking about this guy who has a theory that generations go cyclically and the millennial generation are what are called civic generations. The two examples that he gives of civic generations are the greatest generations and the millennials, because they're like-minded. They tend to have very similar viewpoints, which is the case with millennials. You know, even though they're far more diverse in terms of race and, you know, I guess gender also, like there's a lot more diversity among millennials than any past generation, but they are more like-minded. They vote together and kind of act together more so than the baby boomers. If you think of the baby boomers, like we've just spent the last 20, 30 years living through what the world looks like with the baby boomers in charge. And it's like 50% believe this thing and the other 50% will fight them to the death because they believe that thing. The millennials tend to actually agree on stuff and they're more civic minded. They're more interested in doing things for the greater good. The quote greatest generation fought in World War II and like sacrificed their lives. When you look at polls and millennials' responses to questions, they tend to be much more selfless than previous generations.
I wonder, and this is a theory I'm completely making up right now, but I wonder if because this generation is statistically the least religious generation that we've ever had, that focus of contributing to something bigger than them is a result of lacking that in the religious sense. We know a lot of 12-step programs focus on giving yourself up to a higher power or realizing that there's something bigger than you, and whether that means God or just being spiritual. I wonder if because this is the least religious generation, and maybe there is something just inherent in society and humanity that we need to feel that there's something we're contributing to something bigger than us, because that energy isn't going into religion, it's going into civic duty.
The one thing that the two generations have in common, the greatest generation and the millennials, they don't have the religion thing in common. So the greatest generation was very religious. The millennials are, like you said, the least religious. They both lived through a surprise attack on their home country, Pearl Harbor and 9/11. I think that might be what brings them together, is because that's one of their formative memories, is like being attacked as a country. That's my theory on why that cycle restarted with them. I think you could also say that even just looking beyond America, millennials are diverse in the viewpoints that they take in because of the internet. Like, if you look at anyone's group of friends today, they're going to be a much more diverse group of people, hopefully, or at least they can be. They have that opportunity.
They're also more likely to take on a label that hasn't been used as much before. So like sexual identity, gender identity, that's more likely to be out in the open. That's not to say there are more gay people or more trans people. They've always existed, but they haven't been given the opportunity to be out in the open about it.
Self-identify.
Right, yeah. Right.
And when you have an identity like that, it's a lot easier to kind of ease into embracing it, because you can go online and you can be out online and not in person. You can explore ideas online.
And you can be those things at a young age as well. Yeah. Whereas before, you're right, there probably were the same amount of gay people and trans people throughout the history of humanity, but a lot of people either didn't tell anyone or might have told a few people when they were 50 and decided to fuck it and live their truth. But now we're looking at the millennial generation, and yeah, these are the people who are most comfortable at 15 being like, yes, this is who I am.
A lot of it is just, it's not polite to talk about a lot of things. There was a divorce in my family a few generations ago where they just pretended it never happened and changed all the kids' last names. Oh, and we're gosh. Like, no, it's just, this is how it's been. And that now is not even as taboo. I think microaggressions are a great example of something that when you talk about, oh, this thing bothers me, and you have a lot of people from all over the world who can be like, yeah, no, that is also happening, and we can all kind of talk about this together. An example of like a microaggression is when something small that doesn't seem offensive on its face actually hurt somebody a lot. Like,
yeah, like if you're asking a person of color, like, where are you from?
Oh, yeah. Like, where are you from, though? Like, where are you from? Yeah. Oh, I'm from Culver City. No, where are you from? You
know? Right. They're also, as I understand, like, cumulative. Having it said to you once, it's fine, I guess. But then, like, having it said to you over and over again. For sure. Women, it would be told, smile. Like, the first time
you
that happened.
Smile more. You're so pretty when you smile.
Exactly. Ugh. The first time you're told that, it's like not a big deal. You know,
but that's so nice. It's a compliment, yeah, right, Kate?
It's like when your boss calls you Brent or Brad all the time, and you're like, sure, okay, maybe.
Yes, sir. Those are overt aggressions, you guys. Yeah. Those are not microaggressions.
Or when a bunch of guys talks over a woman who's trying to make a point.
Sorry.
The first time that was said to me, it caught me off guard. I was like, and it made me kind of self-conscious. I was like, wait, what is he talking about? I thought I was looking normal. I thought I looked normal. Then when it happens, each time it's not like I'm not traumatized by it. I'm not angry. It gets tiring. It gets annoying. And it's sort of like, maybe don't do that.
I guess it's understandable to see why the boomer generation is like, microaggressions, when I was your age, I had sticks in my eyes, or I worked in a coal mine.
We've already established that when Brett and I grew up, we had sticks in our eyes and rocks for shoes.
Oh, right. So, yes. Sure.
And that's the way they liked it.
Yeah. When something like that happens, it's very easy to convince yourself it's your problem. I'm just being oversensitive. To kind of put it in like an experience that I think is like relatable to like straight white men, there's a great Onion article that's guy unclear if this is male bonding or bullying. And it's a guy who's just like giving him shit in the bar. And he's like, I don't know if you're trying to be my friend or just being a dick to me. Right. And this is how I've always imagined it is for women or minorities going through microaggressions, where it's easy to convince yourself, no, I'm at fault here. Part of the increase in communication as with technology and with social media has allowed people to be like, hey, does it drive everybody else just fucking crazy how they're doing this all the time? People right. are like, yeah, no, oh my God, stop telling me to smile. It has spread, and now we get to have a conversation about it where before it was impolite to talk about that.
Yeah, and the problem where this buffs up against the older generation is people are like, oh, who cares about microaggression? Who cares? And the answer is what you said. A lot of people were like, oh, yeah, this bothers all of us. Why should we have to deal with this?
Right.
All we're asking is for you to please stop it.
There was a white male barrier. We've talked before about how one of the people who was responsible for the popularization of the Bechdel test went to UCLA film school and wanted to become a screenwriter, was told she was very talented, but she kept getting the feedback from her screenwriting teachers, both male and female, that her characters needed to be either white male or she needed them to talk more about white males. There was a literal barrier there that people were just like, this isn't what we talk about in movies. This isn't what we talk about on TV. We don't complain about that stuff because nobody's going to know what you're talking about or something like that. The internet was literally the breaking down of a barrier that I think is hugely underrated in how big that barrier was and how important that barrier was in keeping people from talking about how fucking annoying it is to live in a culture dominated by white male voices.
The response to that is being seen this year, and we'll probably see it like 3 years from now when the studios catch up and realize that it's not an accident. You know, one of the biggest movies this year is Get Out, a movie that speaks to a non-white audience. And then the week that we record this podcast, the three biggest movies in the United States are Fast, you know.
Fate of the Furious.
Fate of the whatever.
Speak correctly.
I've only seen Fast Five, guys. I'm sorry.
That's all right. It's the best one.
And then the two.
Yeah, that is the best one by far.
The number two and three movies are How to Be a Latin Lover, which is a movie that was marketed towards the Latin audience. And it stars one of the biggest.
Posters were in Spanish.
Yeah. And it has a lot of American actors and comic actors in it. But the star of it is this huge Mexican comic actor. And then the third biggest movie is the sequel to biggest Indian movie ever, like the right. Avatar of India. The sequel came out in America and it was marketed really well in New Jersey and Michigan, which have really big populations. And that's the third biggest movie this week. It's going to be interesting in a few years if the Universals and Warner Brothers catch on and they're like, all right, we need to make a pandering movie to people of color, because that's what the box office receipts will show.
I've been saying for a long time now that, like, well, they can't ignore this now, can they? And they have for a long time, but I do think that it's now, especially with box office, now that China is, I think, officially the biggest market. I think they are bigger than us now.
I think they passed us around this year.
Yeah, it's Bahubali 2, which I was sitting at our editorial meeting on Friday looking through the projections for the upcoming box office weekend. And I was like, oh, is there like some Disney movie I've never heard of called Bahubali? I was like, I'm officially old.
But even the
because they were talking about it like this is going to be the biggest movie of the weekend.
Well, I thought they were projecting it to be like somewhere around 9 or 10, and it jumped to number 3 over the weekend. Even the American prognosticators didn't really know how big it was going to be.
Yeah. Was it number three in America?
I believe so.
Oh, wow.
And what this, and it seems like what this comes down to is just rules of manners that aren't written down anywhere are changing between generations, and like the older generation is not keeping up, which is not an indictment of them. It's extremely difficult to follow social rules, which have been changing quicker and quicker as technology moves on. As the world changes more quickly, the rules for engaging in each other in it change more quickly. People get left behind more quickly. And then, you know, at a certain point, you get to a certain age and you don't want to change your habits anymore. And you don't want to learn more. A microaggression is really just a new phrase that's rude, that you didn't know was rude before. And you always have to learn, wait, okay, so here's the context I'm allowed to say shit. And here's the context I'm not allowed to say shit. And that changes as you get older. And, oh, this is how I behave in these contexts. I know how to go to a wedding now. I know how to go to, it's like, okay. And then at a certain point, it's just like, I don't want to learn that another thing I say is rude. I know I will get to that point and be just as left behind as people who right now are saying microaggressions.
Well, I think sticks in my eye. I think there's a real media backlash against the idea that millennials are more fair-minded, more progressive than previous generations. There was an article that made the claim that millennials are more sexist than previous generations. It had some survey question that went along the lines of, is it better for everyone if women stay home and take care of household duties? And they were like, look at this little graph. The sexism line shoots right up, saying that more millennials are saying than previous generations that it's true that women should stay home. And what they did basically was take this already smallish survey. If you take that and then you reduce it even more, and they limited the age range. So it wasn't just millennials. It was a very specific age range of millennials that they narrowed.
The most sexist millennials that we have.
By the time they were done, it was about 60 people in this graph. And they didn't include the error margins, which are like huge. It presents this very unpleasant picture, but you can manipulate statistics, especially a visual, you can manipulate to look very unflattering. And when you looked at the larger survey and looked at all of the millennials that had been surveyed, it was like 80-something percent of them disagreed with the idea that women should stay at home, so it was more than previous generations, which is not a big surprise. It's not to say that millennials are the only ones who are moral. It's just changing attitudes. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's moving in the direction we expect things to move, where women are allowed to work.
Yeah.
Hot take, but I think women should be allowed to work.
Dames in the office, please.
I know. You believe it?
I just like
next
the word
thing
dames.
You know, we can't smoke cigarettes in people's faces.
But that article that Katie was referring to was a New York Times article. This happens with every generation. This is a thing that always happens. The younger generation is in generally going to be more morally progressive, and they're also going to be smarter. Every 10 years, the SAT questions are going to get harder, and the SAT scores are still going to go up because people just get smarter. From the time of cavemen to today, we've gotten smarter. Our culture has built on top of itself, and it's a progressive thing. Your kids are going to be way smarter than you, and you just have to let that happen and be okay with it. A lot of people's time will be saved if you just acknowledge that. It was a New York Times article that was using a sample size of 60, and Sarge, like, how often on our editorial calls do we sit there and we're reading about a survey and we're like, oh man, that's like an amazing piece of information, or like, that's such a surprising finding. And let's look at the survey size.
It's 36 college kids right. from the same dorm.
Right, exactly. And we throw it out immediately. And
it
the New York Times didn't do the work that Cracked does. Yeah. Like, on
hashtag
our fucking
failing New York yeah. Times.
On our
sad.
Fucking editorial.
And I mean, commenters can go and find articles from years ago before we figured this out. Because there was like a long time ago where we like didn't know that science is just trying to lie to all of us all the time. Right. As much as I love scientists, also, they need funding and they need sensationalist results. And it's hard to find people to eat these crackers or whatever the study is.
Well, and I think it's important to note that this isn't the Drudge Report or Breitbart doing these articles. These are all sorts of, it's across the board, this kind of weird stuff that's angry at millennials really sells. One of our guys, Logan Trent, did this great tweet. Have you guys seen that? Where it's like, he has this list of news stories that's just millennials are killing X industry. Like millennials are killing lunch. Millennials are killing napkins. Millennials are killing cable. Millennials are killing the golf industry. It's one of my favorite tweets.
The best one is promiscuous millennials are killing McDonald's.
Why? What does that have to do with anything?
I don't know.
They're too busy fucking and not eating McDonald's.
But I kind of wanted to go over like how bullshit each one of these are. So the millennials are killing lunch because they're snacking instead because it's more affordable. They have less money. They have less time. So they're snacking instead of eating lunch. I guarantee you, if millennials could sit down to a hot meal every lunch, oh, they would. They would take that opportunity. But like if they're eating potato chips at their desk because they're so stressed and busy and they don't have the spending money, it's so odd to phrase that as like millennials are killing lunch. Yes. Versus millennials aren't able to go to lunch anymore.
It's instead of just saying, hey, the next generation does things different, it's they're attacking our values.
And they're also reacting to a worsening economy. Everybody's reacting to that. You can use statistics in such a way to be like, this generation eats less lunch than the previous generations. And it's like, yeah, because this generation is alive at a time when the economy is worse and there are fewer jobs.
I was going to say, and the use of the word killing, the millennial generation is replacing the past generation. As time goes on, time reduces us all to dust. We're afraid of the next generation killing us. Well, the boomers are afraid of the millennials killing them and taking their land. And that's 100% our plan. So,
ask yourself why the scariest thing in a horror movie that you can possibly see is a child. It's because we realize they're all going to kill us and replace us.
Are we sure the article is not millennials are killing lunch? Like, they are just smashing lunches, you guys. Like, after we're done recording, I'm going to go kill some lunch.
Maybe they see us say, like, killing it, and they're like, oh, my God, they're all murderers. The other one's like, killing napkins because we use paper towels instead because paper towels are so much cheaper. I do this. Why would I buy stupid napkins when I can buy paper towels, which are the same thing.
And a better product.
A better product. I can use it for anything I want. Like, what?
You take a few paper towels and you fold them up and now you have a plate.
I was going to say, I don't even buy plates. I just have paper towels.
I can make a cute hat out of them. It's just, the uses are endless.
And then you do.
I don't have a bath towel, just paper towels.
That's sad. But millennials are killing cable because why are we going to buy cable when we can stream things on Netflix? I would challenge this because I doubt it's millennials. I think everyone's killing cable.
You don't even know how to say it.
The cables.
You're such a millennial.
There's going to be this, you know how we make fun of old people for being like, the internet. Younger people are going to be like, oh, the VCRs.
Right. Well, that is actually correct.
This is my favorite one. Millennials are killing the golf industry. Oh, no.
What are we going to do without golf?
Today's episode is about millennials, and we've got the perfect sponsor for that crowd, Adam and Eve, because there is nothing this young generation likes more than biblical fornication. I'm told that's not what Adam and Eve sells. They sell sex toys, which actually does fit well with millennials and their Snapchatting and sexting and... So whatever your orientation or place on the gender spectrum may be, make sure to head down to adamandeve.com to get an adventurous new toy or movie to share with your partner, partners, or yourself. We're not judging. And for a limited time, go to adamandeve.com and use our promo code CRACKED to get 50% off just about any one item in the store. And that's not all. If you use promo code CRACKED, you'll also get 3 free adult DVDs and a free mystery gift. So once again, check out adamandeve.com and enter coupon code CRACKED, that's CRACKED, to get 50% off any one item. And when you do, you'll get 3 free adult DVDs, a free extra gift, and free shipping too. That's adamandeve.com and use CRACKED at checkout. Hey guys, do you love books like I do, but find you never have the time to actually sit down and read them? We've got a solution for you, and it's Audible. With Audible, you can finally catch up on reading Cracked's book, You Might Be a Zombie, or anything on your reading list by listening to all the books you've been meaning to read on the go. Their app is free. They also have something called the Great Listen Guarantee. So if you don't like a book, you can just exchange it for a new one. No questions asked. And in addition to You Might Be a Zombie, they have audiobooks from crack writers like How to Fight Presidents by Daniel O'Brien, Futuristic Violence and Fancy Suits by David Wong, and Robert Evans's new book, A Brief History of Vice. Listen, as Ben Franklin always said, you can't make more time, but you can make the most of it. Actually, I think Audible just said that for the first time, but well done, Audible. Turn your commute or chores or workout into something more with a free trial at audible.com. So go to audible.com/cracked to start now.
It's important to note that millennials are making 20% less than the previous generation. That's huge. That's really significant. 40% of America's unemployed are millennials. We may be more woke, but we're definitely not making as much money. Going back to this Simon Sinek guy being really smug about millennials not understanding the real world, it's just so frustrating because we're just struggling to find jobs and get paid and have money. And just like we were talking about before, how you get trained to expect a certain standard, we looked at our parents. They had homes and they had moderately well, not everybody, this is not the global experience, and I recognize that, but we saw them doing better than us. So now we're very frustrated to kind of sneer at the idea that millennials are less happy. It's like, maybe they're less happy because they don't have money. They don't have a house when their parents at the same age did have a house. It's very discouraging.
Yeah, we didn't complete the Simon Sinek argument, but he basically said, so they like get all these participation trophies and they're told they're special by their parents and their parents argue their way into honors classes. And then they get out into the real world and they suddenly find that they don't just get a cushy corporate job just because their parents complain for them, and they don't just get handed $100,000 a year without working for it. So now we're seeing what happens. He's like, and now we're seeing the suicide rate is going way up among millennials. The suicide rate is going way up among millennials. It's going way up among everybody because the economy has gotten worse. That's one of the things you have to separate out. Whenever you're reading a things that millennials are doing, the sky is falling article, ask yourself whether, okay, is this just millennials or is this applying to everybody? In the case of if it's an economic thing, it applies to everybody. Everybody's tightening their belts. The economy has gotten worse over the past decade. The other thing to ask yourself is whether this is just a thing that younger people tend to do differently than the rest of the people around them. One example is I've seen it claimed that millennials are way more likely to want to live in an apartment in the city than their previous generations. That's actually not true. Millennials are more likely to live in the city than anyone else in America today. But when you compare them to past generations, they're actually more focused on eventually getting out to the suburbs and having a house than any generation before them. They're like very focused on having the white picket fence. You just would never see that brought up because it doesn't fit into our picture of millennials. There's just like a whole genre of stock photos that are used that define millennials. Girls with headbands.
It's all me and my buddies. It's just hanging out, the being Pepsi millennials.
Ad. Yeah, it's the Pepsi ad. The Pepsi ad and
our earbuds and our slip-on sneakers.
The other one that I was thinking of is that Zac Efron DJ movie.
There's also just these surveys that are totally misrepresenting what they're actually asking. He claims that there's this science that millennials are more narcissistic. When you look at the actual survey, it asks questions like, I am assertive, or I wish I were more assertive. And they flag that as a marker of narcissism when that to me just denotes confidence. When you ask if someone's assertive, the only thing you're really measuring is assertiveness. Why are you saying, oh, that's narcissism? it's such a bizarre extrapolation from a question that has nothing to do with narcissism that it makes me question the motivation behind that study.
I feel like the best way to measure narcissism would be to draw a picture of the universe and say, mark how close you are to the center of it. And then everyone who just dots the middle and is like, here's me, then you know they're a narcissist.
Maybe put them by a lake, and if they stare at their reflection until they die and get turned into a flower, that would, you know. Greek myth joke!
Yeah.
Millennials
keeping
with
it
your
fresh.
Greek myth
with
jokes
your education.
And you hate lunch.
Millennials are killing it with the Greek myth references. What amazes me is I feel like every single complaint about millennials, they're all really vague, cookie-cutter things people say about any group that they don't like that they're entitled. That snack guy, he was so smug. He's so unbelievably smug in that video. It's all like, oh, they're entitled and they don't know how to work, and they're reiterating the stock complaints about generations we've been hearing for years. It's a Simpsons joke they made in the early 90s.
Yeah.
Old man yells at cloud, Principal Skinner saying, am I out of touch? No, it is the children who are wrong. There's a book called The Time Has Come to Say the Things That Must Be Said by K. Ross Toole, where he complains about the next generation is too dependent on technology and they're absorbing information faster than they can process it and don't know how to contextualize it. And they're too oversensitive with language, and they don't respect authority,
and this
and they don't know how to work hard. And this book was written in
2009, right?
1971.
Oh, no!
Oh, thanks for setting me up. That was great. It was like, slam dunk by K. Ross Toole about the boomers, about the baby boomers.
Exactly.
What's amazing about the book to me is that anytime Dr. K. Ross Toole talks about the past, he's really insightful, and it's like this really interesting historical analysis. And then he starts talking about the next generation, and he's just wrong. Time has proven him wrong. At one point, he's like, hey, I know the environment stuff seems bad. Don't worry about it. We're going to have this taken care of in like a decade tops.
Listen, give me another Marlboro.
Yeah.
Those ice caps aren't going anywhere.
Nuclear proliferation? Don't be too concerned. I don't foresee this being an issue past the mid-90s. It's bananas stuff. It's like we have blinders on where we can't look at the next generation because we know they're going to replace us and kill us and eat us, and it fills our hearts with fear.
Not for lunch, though. They'll eat us for breakfast or dinner or a mid-afternoon snack.
Brunch.
There's a comedian that made this really funny joke about how, well, the next generation are going to be the first ones to be immortal. Just how angry that made this comedian. And it was just like, think about it. We're the last ones that are going to die.
I'm personally stoked to be the last one who's going to die because I'm someone who is very affected by death. I'm someone from a young age, if I saw death in a movie, it would really emotionally affect me. But a solace that I've taken is that as I've seen my grandparents get older and die and other people, everyone when they're like 80 is like pretty ready to go. Like, my grandmother, when she was alive, told me, she's like, I'm stoked that I don't have to learn that much. Like, I know how to email you. I know how to email my grandchildren. I don't want to learn anything else. I'm pretty happy, and it's going to be fun as I'm 80, and I'm going to be like, see you later, suckers, I'm dying. And the next generation's like, no, we have to stay here forever.
See, I'm the opposite. I want a robot body and live forever and not die, but, you know.
And be our tyrant overlord.
Sure, yeah, eventually I'll accrue power overall, but, you know, that's the long-term goal.
I feel like if you're getting a robot body and you're not trying to rule, you're wasting your robot
wasting
body.
Wasting your potential.
I do wonder how much of being ready to die is just the failing of the body, and if their brain was transported into a young 28-year-old NBA player's body, your grandma would have been like, nice.
Should have been like, let's do some Steph crossovers on you. Broken ankles, Brett.
Never mind. Super want to figure out Snapchat now. Seems worth it.
Yeah. Have you guys heard that old people are taking young people's blood and putting it into their bodies to make themselves stronger?
Is that true?
It's true.
That's what Kobe Bryant was doing.
That's terrifying.
So there's mice studies that they take old mice and put young mice blood in the old mice, and the old mice do better. They are physically better. Their brains function better. It seems to be good for them. And I believe there's some famous mogul who claims to be putting young people blood in his body to make him stronger.
Probably Steve Elon Jobs. Musk. Elizabeth Bathory. Elon Musk looks like he's in a vampire movie.
Geez, Jack, we got to tell you.
Didn't work?
Didn't work.
That seems like such a soft science sci-fi channel original movie idea. Like, just inject yourself full of blood. I got all this new blood. Like, what?
Well, you know, that's what blood doping is. That's what Lance Armstrong got in trouble for. It would be his own blood, but he would work out in such a way that his blood would be like really rich with oxygen, and he would take that blood out of his veins, put it in like a vial somewhere, and then inject it back into his veins during the Tour de France.
That so his works. Blood can take yeah, more oxygen.
It's
up.
Just like getting better blood.
All right, never mind. Yeah, fucking injecting blood is a great idea. Dude. Let's all do it, I guess.
I've been wanting to inject children's blood into me forever.
If I take some blood out when I'm feeling creative and like I'm in the groove, and then later I'm in a rut and can't think of an article premise, I can just inject that. Will that work?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think so.
Yes. Cut to... So Josh won't be coming in. He OD'd on his own blood.
Some corrections blood. To the things I very confidently just said. first of all, the guy is Peter Thiel, and he wants to inject himself with young people's blood. He is not currently injecting himself with young people's blood. He doesn't have like a Mad Max style millennial hooked up to him.
You put that intention out there, and you know.
If you need to imagine Peter Thiel driving a Ford Falcon down the desert with an upside down millennial pumping blood into him, you can. That's not what we're saying.
It's just not happening yet. As for the mice studies, they're controversial, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt. Sometimes these studies are like, we just put a mouse head on a weasel body, therefore head transfusions can happen. Like that guy who's like, I'm going to do a head transfusion. He takes a banana and like puts spaghetti in it, and he takes the other half of a banana and puts it together, and you're like, that's how it's going to work.
That's a real thing, right?
Yeah.
What's happening? Has it happened yet?
It hasn't.
The spaghetti thing? Yes.
Well, no, a guy is going to get a head transplant.
Well,
nobody can get a head transplant.
He says he's going to. Most likely, he's not going to be approved, and this is just a bravado where he knows he's not going to be approved. If he does it, it will be horrifying, because there is no way. If we were anywhere near a head transplant, we would be curing people's paralysis. That would be the first thing to do. The only way it would work is if like his body was fully paralyzed. And in that case, it would just be awful. Like, this guy's existence would not be great. And no, you can't do that. Also, he would die immediately.
Also, the first thing we would do with that would not be curing, like, paralysis. You would see, like, Hugh Hefner's head on, like, a jacked...
On, like The Rock's body.
Yeah, like, on The Rock's body. Or, it'd be like some young person on a baby's body.
Like, a very, like, a primitive...
I can fuck forever now.
Super, like, primitive version of Get Out, where it's just like, we'll skip the brain transplant part and just, like, stick an old person's head on, like, a young, strong person's body.
One millennial stereotype that I will put out there is that millennials often don't know how to say words correctly. And it's just because they've spent their whole lives texting or reading.
Yeah,
words.
Exactly.
They read and write more than any generation ever before them. And they probably speak words out loud less than any generation.
Are you referencing a word that Katie or I may have used in the past few minutes that you're about to bring it up?
Maybe. Maybe.
Yeah, you have the ability to do that little click, I know on Macs at least, where the word turns yellow and the little bubble pops up and it gives you the dictionary definition of that word.
I'm not saying the definition. I'm saying...
I know exactly, but we have this ability to look up any word we want and put that in our lexicon.
Yeah, they have amazing vocabularies. They just don't know how to say the
word. But no one knows international phonetic English, so they can't see, you know, the upside down E and the schwas. Yeah.
I think 70% of people mispronounce biopic.
I call it biopic, but some people call it biopic.
I think that's officially wrong, isn't it?
I would say that's wrong.
It's not a generational thing necessarily. Like, everybody does this, but I just think that it's particularly a blind spot of millennials because of the circumstances of them knowing more words than any other generation and saying fewer words.
We know the connotation of them, but not the pronunciation of them.
that's exactly right.
There it is. This is now going to turn into old millennial asking young millennial questions like you are science.
As the millennial take. Giving you the millennial take.
Did you guys like go nuts when Bin Laden was killed? Were you like in the streets spraying beer on each other? Just the two of you?
I wasn't.
Just me and Katie. I don't know you.
The Bin Laden one was so weird because it was the night after the correspondence dinner.
You had already been rioting after the correspondence
dinner. So that was like one of his best correspondence dinners. He just killed it. And I forgot who the Obama host was. Obama was. And then the next day, you started seeing on Twitter, on the news, special report. The president's going to address the nation at 9 p.m. Eastern tonight.
And well, The Rock broke the story.
Oh, really?
The Rock was the first person who knew on Twitter. It was like some right-wing correspondent, and then The Rock was like, I'm so proud of my brothers and the special services. Oh, wow. I do a killer, The Rock.
That's perfect.
And yeah, he like already knew about it before anybody else.
Yeah, it just slowly kind of leaked through Twitter and cable news during the afternoon into the evening that like Bin Laden might be dead. And then Obama comes out and he just walks down the Rose Garden. Like, he's looking like The Rock, looking like Stone Cold Steve Austin doing that walk down the thing. And he's like, hey, guys, I did it.
I don't remember feeling excited. I don't know. I felt kind of relief, like, good, this is over. We can't use this to justify more war.
That's interesting.
I think that at that point, I was just so tired. My goodwill over 9/11 wore out. Years and years ago, my feeling of we all got to band together and like stick together, and that swell of patriotism lasted maybe a month. Mm-hmm. And then once we started bombing the shit out of the Middle East over it, it was just like I became very jaded and cynical about it. The idea of being excited over someone's death just became so disturbing and tiring. I was so tired of it. I was tired of the we bomb them, we're gonna bomb them. I have no love for Bin Laden. He's just another one of these assholes that gets people killed, and I'm not sad he's dead. I'm slightly relieved. It's not celebratory. I don't feel happy. I don't feel jazzed about it. At least this chess piece is off the board, I guess.
Yeah, you do think of people as chess pieces. I noticed that.
An identical reaction. It felt like Bin Laden hadn't represented a credible threat in a long time. I didn't understand why we were still afraid of him in particular. It was such an unclear military conflict. It didn't seem like it was the end of anything. It didn't feel like we'd won. Nobody was coming back to life. I think I was eating lunch. I can't even tell you when it was. 2011? Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Yeah, I think I was living in D.C. and I was eating lunch, and then I was like, well, back to work.
Yeah, it was like just a game of hide and seek at that point. It's not like he was calling the shots and like still dunking on us or anything.
We certainly didn't stop bombing the Middle East. Like, we kept doing that, so nothing changed.
Yeah. Was 9/11 when you guys were pretty young?
I was in the 7th grade, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was 13.
That was the one thing that when I objectified millennials as like, oh, they're different from me, is when Bin Laden was killed and all these college campuses were just in the streets celebrating. I was like, oh, weird. That might be because of how foundational September 11th was in their memory.
I was 1 year out of college. If I had still been in college, I might have been out there celebrating because I didn't want to go to class.
Yeah, if anything, it just seems like a college thing. Like, it's another excuse to drink? Sure.
That ties into the complaint about college students being oversensitive, which is something people have been saying about college students for as long as we've had college. College students don't want to go to class. They want to go protest. And they do. And I'm not saying that college students don't believe in shit, because they do. But a lot of them also just don't want to go to class.
They're also super repressed and stressed. You give them an excuse to go out in the streets, they'll go. And a lot of schools do this where you have primal scream and you get naked and run around because it's just there's so much pressure and stress that people are just like, I need to act like an animal for just an hour.
My college did not have that, but continue.
Yeah, I've never heard of that.
Really? I was told this was normal.
I have friends who did that as a bit, and I was like, man, you guys are enjoying this way too much.
I was not really expecting it when I was a freshman. And what they do is they run around the freshman quad. They're butt naked and it's in the middle of winter. I just heard a lot of screaming.
Are they wearing masks?
No. I never did this because people would sneak in and take photos. And it was kind of alarming to look out. And then because like there was screaming too. Screaming at the top of your lungs while running around naked. I think that college students just are stressed out and need a form of group therapy that often takes the form of protest or nakedness.
So maybe the whole celebration that Bin Laden was dead was just, it was a thing to celebrate.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And college students are very much discovering their identity and what it means to express themselves and say something. And you get to vote your freshman year of college. Those are the first 4 years you're a citizen and you're still in school and you're figuring out, like, I have all these freedom of speech things. I can say all these things. I can protest people. What does it mean? Where are the lines? That's my big pet peeve whenever anyone talks about millennial protests and college protests. And that's why we have college. They're learning how to do this. I learned how to do it there.
Yeah, and I also don't want to oversimplify protests. Often college students will protest very important things. They're being more politically active than a lot of us, and we should be looking up to them, not looking down our noses at them. Like, that's admirable that they're enthusiastic and politically active and put their money where their mouth is in terms of their politics.
Yeah, I mean, that is one thing that is unique to millennials that they have in common with the greatest generation, like in that cyclical generational theory, is that they're more politically engaged and politically motivated and willing to go out and protest together. And I think that also has to do with them being all in together instead of being divided like the baby boomer generation.
There's also this hypocrisy where often older generations will complain about how all politicians are the same and the political parties are both corrupt. And then when the younger generations protest everybody, they're like, why are you protesting everyone and everything? When younger generations protest Obama with the drone strikes, they're like, come on, just calm down. It's like, well, you're the ones who are always complaining that everything's the same and nothing ever changes. So why are you complaining when the younger generations are like, we don't like this?
Fucking Obama, man.
I love the idea of Obama hearing that Bin Laden's dead, being like, good, inform the rock.
All right, that was our episode. One thing we didn't really cover is that in the same way that millennials and the greatest generation or the GI generation, the people who fought World War II, can be kind of linked as both civic generations, generational theory says that the baby boomers have an equivalent generation in the lost generation, the ones who came up during World War I, who were characterized by feelings of alienation and insecurity and anger at the world, your Hemingways and F. Scott Fitzgerald. The Lost Generation was actually right before the World War II Greatest Generation. And when the Greatest Generation was going off to fight Hitler with their bare hands during World War II, the Lost Generation complained that they weren't cut out to be soldiers because they were, quote, mother's boys, sissies, and soft. They probably wanted free food and to fight for a cause that was greater than themselves and other crybaby shit like these millennials. Am I right, Simon? All right, on to footnotes. We're going to link off to a bunch of cracked articles. We're going to link off to one called This Millennial Rant Deserves a Trophy for Being Most Wrong. That is our takedown of the Simon Sinek video. We're going to link off to one called Lies Millennials and Baby Boomers Believe About Each Other, and one called Terrible Parts of Pop Culture with Weird Bright Sides. Number one, the last entry in that article is about how every generation's complaints about the generation that's coming up behind them just are basically always the same. We're also going to link off to an article in the Society Pages called Adventures in Garbage Millennial Confirmation Bias. That's the statistical analysis of how the New York Times basically cheated to make millennials look like assholes. We'll link off to a New Yorker article called The Big Uneasy that is actually fairly critical of millennials. It's about Oberlin College and just how things are going these days. It's a pretty interesting read. We'll link off to a couple other New Yorker articles we used for research. And we'll link off to one of the books by Morley Winograd, who is the generational theorist who writes about millennials, despite being an older gentleman and having a redonkulously outdated website. He's actually pretty complimentary of millennials. He's the one who has all the comparisons between millennials and the greatest generation. And I'm taking most of the stuff I'm attributing to him from interview notes for an article we never ended up running. So hopefully I'm not butchering too much of it. But yeah, we had Robert interview him because we assumed he was just going to be this completely full of shit, scaremongering person just based on a photograph of him with the Chyron millennial expert because he appeared on CNN as their millennial expert. Turns out he's actually really knowledgeable and was actually a really interesting interview that we just couldn't fit into a cracked article. Anyways, we fit it into a cracked podcast, and that's going to do it for this week. Thanks to engineer Brett, who you can follow on Twitter at Brett, R-A-D-E-R. You can follow me at Jack_O-B-R-I-E-N, and we'll be back next week with more podcast. Talk to you guys then.
Movies.
Ben Affleck's performance in this movie will outlive us all.
Do you like arguing?
I'm gonna say that you're insane.
Do you like movies and then arguing about them with like people or strangers on the internet or Twitter or whatever?
Never ending story goes in the canon over Ghostbusters?
Oh, yeah, are you serious?
No way!
I am Amy Nicholson, and I am the host of the show The Canon, where every week we debate whether or not a film deserves to be anointed into the canon of all-time classic flicks.
It is a masterpiece unto itself.
If you want to weigh in, listen to the show. See you there.
You don't get any better!
This has been an Earwolf production. Executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.